Welcome, members and guests, to the September 12th program of the City Club of Eugene. Greetings to our broadcast audiences on community television, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Our program today is Ballot Measure Speed Dating. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President for 2014 and 15. A special thank you to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the broadcasts on their website. Our sponsors today are Evans, Elder, and Brown, Capella Market, Eugene's Neighborhood Grocer, and KLCC. And for supplying our office space, we thank KPFF Consulting Engineers. A quick reminder that these programs are free for our listening audience, but it does cost real money to produce them and lots of volunteer effort. Your contributions are most welcome and are completely tax deductible. For our KLCC listening audience on Monday nights, please consider becoming a virtual member. Virtual members can join for just $40 a year. This will help keep the radio programs on KLCC and support the club, even if you can't attend our meetings. Virtual members support the club and keep nearly 50 programs per year aired on the radio every Monday evening. Please welcome our new member, Stefan Ostrich, and our newest sponsor, the Waymore Center for Law and Politics. Our program today is coordinated by our past president, Marty Wilde, and here he is to introduce the program.
Hello, and welcome to our ballot measure speed dating program. Today we'll be addressing four of the seven ballot measures, and we'll have proponents for all four and opponents for three who will try to persuade you and our listening audience to vote pro or con. City Club has invited both sides for all four. On the ERA, the ACLU declined to participate in our program today. So I will introduce all of our presenters, and then we will get started. Each side will have 5 minutes. There will not be cross questions or anything like that. They'll rotate through the podium, and then when we get to the question and answer session, I'll try to fit everybody up here, and then you will field your questions at that point. So our presenters today are, on Measure 88, Alternative Driver Licensing, we have Jeff Stone, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and Mark Hallahan from Oregonians for Immigration Reform. On the Measure 89, the Equal Rights Amendment, we have Aaron Gold, who is a local attorney. On Measure 91, which is on marijuana legalization, regulation, and taxation, we have Casey Houlihan, a local businessman, to speak on pro, and Daryl Fuller from the Oregon Sheriff's Association. And I understand there's traffic on I-5 coming south, so he'll be joining us by the time his slot is available. And on Measure 92, on the labeling of genetically modified organisms, we have Scott Bates, the director of GMO Free Oregon, and Dana Bieber, who's a spokesperson for the No on 92 campaign. Please join me in welcoming them. We will get started with Jeff Stone. Each side will have 5 minutes. I'll be sitting there with time cards, and when you're done, I'll rotate through the next speaker.
Good morning, or afternoon now. I am Jeff Stone. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries, a native son of South Eugene and a University of Oregon graduate, so it's always glad to come home to my hometown. Today, what we're going to talk about is why you should support Measure 88, which is a driver's card legislation that was passed by the state House and Senate and signed by the governor. Since we have limited time, and I want to make sure that we have time to ask questions later, I'm going to go into what the driver's card is and is not, the coalition that came through and passed the measure, and kind of why it matters. So what is the driver's card? Well, it's not an 8-year driver's license like you and I have. It is a limited 4-year driver card that only really talks about your ability to pass in a written test, do the driving test, and make yourself eligible for insurance. It also serves as a way to make sure that our roads are safer and it's also paid for by the fees that are levied by the driver card itself. Who is eligible? Seniors, homeless, and yes, undocumented residents. What does the driver card not do? Well, you can't board an airplane, you can't buy a gun, you can't register to vote, you can't put yourself into a situation where you're getting benefits that you would not ordinarily be available for. So those are the things that it is and is not. The coalition that came together to pass this bill came out of work that came from a work group that had a wide variety of folks at the table. Not everybody, but a wide variety. It was convened by the governor. It was passed by wide margins in both the state House and the state Senate and signed by the governor. And it was bipartisan. So there were both Republicans and Democrats who voted for it. And this coalition brought together non-traditional alliances. If you can imagine having the faith community, labor, business, law enforcement, and immigrant rights folks all around the same table to try to pass something so our roads can be safer, that's what happened in the development of this legislation. So why are we even talking about this issue? I mean, that's a valid question. You know why? It's because Congress has failed. Failed to pass immigration reform. And that is the predominant reason that we have even to try to make a common sense approach to deal with the situation that we are dealing with in the state as it is. So the Senate passed a bill. The president supports it. The United States House has blocked it so far. That is disappointing. Because of their dereliction of their duty to pass good policy, this system of immigration has been broken for well over 30 years. So there is a pent-up need to solve the problem. 10 other states have passed a driver privilege in one form or another, including our neighbors in California, Nevada, and Washington. In Oregon, we tried to come together and do something that was just common sense and limited. Oregon has a labor shortage, especially agriculture. I represent the largest sector of agriculture, the nursery and greenhouse industry, and they can't get enough workers. It's hard work to go out and dig trees, prune. It's a very skilled workforce, and there aren't folks willing to do the work. As I said, the immigration system is broken, and we need to try to fix it. But in order for us to continue to have the economic recovery that we need in this state, we need to have measures in order to make sure people can get to work, to church, to school, and to the store. So Oregon is being watched. This is a big issue. It's going to be construed as an immigration issue. Let me tell you something. You can't solve the immigration issue. That's a federal issue. The state can't solve the immigration issue. And it's a matter of what kind of state you want to be. What kind of community do you want to be? There are real economic consequences. If we lost our undocumented workforce, the Oregon economy would shrink by $17 billion. Add 7.7% to the unemployment rolls. Those are people that are not the undocumented folks, but people whose jobs depend on it. So now we have a 14% unemployment rate. And the state would lose $650 million right off the top for their state funds. So we have a hard enough time funding public safety, healthcare, and I'll just close in saying that I would like your support. If we want to solve the immigration issue, let's do it together. But vote yes on Measure 88. It's a common sense approach. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff Stone. And now we have Mark Callahan from Oregonians for Immigration Reform regarding Measure 88.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be back in Eugene. I also am a Eugene native son. I grew up over in the Ferry Street Bridge area, went to Sheldon High School. I did go to Oregon State University, though, because I wanted to study engineering, so don't hold that against me. But I'm here today to represent Oregonians for Immigration Reform and the No on 88 campaign. Ladies and gentlemen, as they say in legal, or real estate, location, location, location. But as we say here in the United States, illegal is illegal is illegal. If you're not here legally, then you're breaking the law. Someone breaks into your house at night, what are you going to do? You're just going to allow them to stay there? You're going to allow them to eat your food? You're going to allow them to associate with your family and take advantage of the family privileges that only your family gets when they're in your home? No, you're going to kick them out. You know, some of us would take out other measures to kick them out. Some of us would call the police. The point is, illegal is illegal is illegal. This has been tried in two other states, at least two other states, New Mexico and Tennessee. Both are in the process of repealing their driver's cards. In New Mexico's instance, they failed to lessen the number of uninsured drivers. It encouraged additional illegal immigration into New Mexico. The state has approximately 49,000 illegal immigrants, yet 80,000 licenses have been issued to foreign nationals. Governor Susana Martinez wants to repeal the New Mexico law, citing problems relating to fraud, human trafficking, and organized crime and national security. Folks, I have two daughters myself. My daughters are 10 and 11 years old. We live in Salem right now. I moved up to Salem about a little over 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. I'm concerned about their safety, ladies and gentlemen. I want my daughters to grow up in a country where they know how to follow the law, where there's not exemptions to that law. In Tennessee's instance here, they stopped issuing driver's certificates in response to non-residents being shuttled to Tennessee from other states. Stopped issuing driver's certificates after a substantial increase of false residency documents and bribery of government officials. And they rescinded the law and ended granting the certificates of driver's immigrants. Folks, this isn't about safety. I looked over Senate Bill 833 this morning, again, and nowhere in this 11-page bill does it say anything about insurance. The folks on the other side, and Mr. Stone's side that he's proposing here, say it's going to make our roads safer. It's not going to make our roads safer, and there's not the law enforcement support that he claims that there is. The sheriffs of Oregon PAC has come out against Measure 88. Folks, that's the sheriffs of Oregon. We have other people like Tom Bergen down in Clatsop County. We have Tim Mueller that basically says giving a person a driver's license who is in this country illegally is flat out irresponsible and does nothing to protect the citizens of our state. Folks, it's about following the law. We are a country of laws. We have our sovereignty. We are a country based on freedom, self-determination, and American exceptionalism. To live in this country, we have to follow our laws. That's what I teach my daughters, to follow the law, because that following the law guarantees freedom. We have a very high unemployment rate in our country right now, ladies and gentlemen. We need to get our country back on the right track, and that means jobs for Americans. Americans that are here legally, not illegally. My colleague Jeff Stone basically says that he needs a workforce. Ladies and gentlemen, when my mother was a young girl, she went out in the fields and picked strawberries. We're facing a crisis as a country here, ladies and gentlemen. We need our work ethic back. We need our will to do what we can to earn what we get because we value it more. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to follow our laws. And as I said, illegal is illegal is illegal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, we have some people still fighting traffic to get here, so we're going to jump to 92, and we'll introduce, I'm introducing you to Scott Bates, who is the director of GMO Free Oregon. He'll be on the pro side for Measure 92.
I'd like to thank everybody for being here. It's a pleasure to be here in Eugene. I'm from up in Portland, but I'm definitely a proud Oregonian for quite a few years now. I am transplanted from the Northwest, so I grew up son of a cheesemaker in the Northwest, so I'm Northwest proud for sure. So Measure 92 is fundamentally about requiring mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods sold at retail at the grocery stores here in Oregon. When you go shopping in a grocery store, if a product was already required to comply with existing federal nutritional labeling requirements. That product, if Measure 92 would pass, would also be required to comply with the requirements of Measure 92. Those requirements simply state that a product, if it is wholly in itself genetically engineered, or if it contains ingredients that have been genetically engineered, that it put a truthful, simple, truthful, and factual statement on its packaging to state that it is produced with genetic engineering. It's a simple statement such as that. In terms of raw commodities at a grocery store, you think about your produce, your corn on the cob, your zucchini, even salmon, if that gets approved by the FDA. That too would need to be labeled by the grocery store, the retailer, in the bulk bin on the signage there at the grocery store. So fundamentally, you need to frame your mind around it is about the grocery store shopping experience and giving you that information, that transparency when you're there shopping. This is not fundamentally a new concept. 64 other countries around the globe have already done this. They already have implemented mandatory GMO labeling requirements. Countries that include almost all of Europe, Russia, China, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, they have all done this already. Citizens of Oregon have a wide variety of reasons why they might want to know about this. The simple idea of transparency and belief and understanding and confidence in the product that you're buying, that you know what it is that you're getting. Perhaps people are concerned about the health effects of GMOs, which are heavily unstudied. There's only been one study ever done on the human health effects of GMOs. That was done in the UK, and it showed a 50% increase in soy allergies over the course of the year when it was first introduced in the UK. Some people might be concerned about increased pesticide exposure with GMOs, or perhaps they have, you know, their own religious reasons, you know, of why, for their religious beliefs, that they want to know whether or not a food has been genetically engineered. Fundamentally, the biggest, you know, battle we fight is education and letting people know what's in there. Labels will take a huge step to providing that and educating customers about giving that information about what it is that they're buying. Our opposition is likely going to try and tell you that that's going to cost you a lot of money. Fundamentally, you know, the information and the research just is not there to state that this is going to cost you nearly anything at all. 64 countries, again, have already done this. There's not a study I can find that shows anywhere that the cost of food has gone up in those countries. So, you know, this fundamentally is just, it's a simple labeling. Cheerios, earlier this year, they put a labeling on there to say, hey, we're non-GMO. It didn't raise the cost of food at all. They didn't change the price of Cheerios. Ben & Jerry's this year has been switching all of their products, their entire product line, over to non-GMO ingredients instead of the GMO-based sugar candy bits that they've had in there. They have not changed the price of their product a bit. So whether a producer chooses to label or a producer chooses to change their ingredients, there's proof that the cost of our food will not go up in any way. Fundamentally, you know, this is a something that appeals to a broad swath of Oregonians. Measure 92 is currently endorsed by the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, the Oregon Nurses Association, United Farm Workers Unions, the State Employees SIU 503 and 49, the City Club of Portland, Friends of Family Farmers, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Sierra Club, and specifically here in Eugene, it's companies like So Delicious, Glory Bee, Coconut Bliss, Falling Sky Brewery, Nancy's Yogurt, Mount Rose Herbs, Circle H Farms, Johnson Vegetable Farms, and Lane County Democrats. Even Peter DeFazio and Paul Holvey have all come out endorsing Measure 92. I encourage all of you to similarly make that step. This is about transparency, giving people the choice to know what is in their food and understand what it is they're buying. Thanks very much. Vote yes on 92.
Next, we have the con argument from Dana Bieber, who's the spokeswoman for No on 92.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and spend just a few minutes talking with you about Measure 92. You know, if you hear the proponents talk about it, they make it sound like it's just a simple right to know. Well, that's where Measure 92 fails. It fails on its fundamental promise to provide consumers with reliable and accurate information as to whether their food contains GMO ingredients or not. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. You know, when the proponents started writing this initiative, they started with a blank sheet of paper. And the very first thing they did is exempt two-thirds of the food and beverage that's sold here. These are indefensible exemptions. And what they end up doing is failing consumers who are looking for accurate and reliable information. I'll give you a few examples of these exemptions. You know, if I were to go into the grocery store and I was to buy a can of pop, that would have to have a label on it. But if I stepped over a few steps over to the deli and got that same drink out of the soda fountain, that wouldn't have to have a label on it. The pizza that I buy in the frozen pizza that at the grocery store, that'd have to have a label on it. But the same pizza that's delivered to my house doesn't have a label on it. It makes no sense. It doesn't provide consumers reliable information. At the same time, there's thousands of food products that actually do contain GE ingredients in them, or GMOs, or are they made with those ingredients? But they get a special exemption. They won't be labeled, so consumers won't know. Examples of that would be any meat, milk, or eggs that came from animals that were fed GMO grains and were injected with GE medications. They get a special exemption. So when you go to the meat counter or the dairy aisle, none of those products will have a label on them because they got a special exemption. But yet they were made with GMO ingredients. That fails consumers. The third area is that, you know, there's going to be thousands of food products that also don't contain any GE ingredients in them, but they do have to be labeled as such. Products like that are sugar or corn oil or cornstarch. Even though they came from a plant that was a GE plant to begin with, once those products are processed, the final product doesn't contain any GE in it. There is no GMO in any sugar, whether it's organic, cane, or GE. Because once it's processed, there's no protein in it. Yet all products that contain sugar or corn oil or cornstarch or soybean oil, they'd have to be labeled saying that they do. That fails consumers. At the same time, I recognize there are consumers out there who want information whether there are GMO in the food. I completely understand that. And fortunately, there are two nationwide labeling systems who provide that information accurately and reliably. Consumers can look for either the organic or the non-GMO label. Both are accurate, both are reliable, and they don't contain all these exemptions that Measure 92 contains. In fact, Measure 92 is so poorly written, it conflicts with those federal labeling standards. It doesn't provide consumers with the useful information that they may be looking for, and it's going to be costly. Make no mistake about it. Numerous of studies have shown that it's going to increase the cost of groceries by at least $400 a year. Okay, but you don't have to take the studies. Let's look at anecdotal evidence. Recently, Ben and Jerry's has said, you know what, we're going to swap out all GMO ingredients. They haven't got there. They're not all the way through the process, but the Wall Street Journal reported this summer that even though they're not even completed with this process, the cost to them, as Ben and Jerry's reports it, has been 5 to 20% increase in the cost of their ingredients. Now, they may or may not pass it on to consumers, but they will readily admit, yeah, it costs more. That's where the cost to consumers come. Chipotle restaurants, they also decided that they wanted to go GMO-free. They, too, have not completed the transition, but last October, their CEO said, you know what, the cost of our food isn't going to have to go up by 3 to 5% to accommodate these non-GMO ingredients. That's where the cost comes to consumers. Consumers will have to pay for increased cost of groceries because food producers will have to either remake their product with higher-priced non-GE ingredients in order to avoid having to put an inaccurate and unreliable label on it. So it's costly to consumers, but you know, it also hurts the farmers of Oregon as well. That's why you will find nearly every major farming organization, the Farm Bureau, the Cattlemen's Association, local farm bureaus, organizations like the Associated Oregon Industries, the Retail Association, all lined up urging a no vote. They know this hurts Oregon farmers. It requires them to implement costly and separate systems for farming, everything from the farm to the grocery store, because there's a zero tolerance level in Measure 92. This is costly and unfair to Oregon farmers. It puts them at a competitive disadvantage because, you know, they would have to comply with a regulatory system that no other farmer in the country has to comply with. That's why our coalition has come together to oppose this misleading labeling initiative. It doesn't provide consumers the information that they may want, and it's costly. We urge no on 92. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dana Bieber. Next, we'll have Measure 91, the Marijuana Legalization, Regulation, and Taxation Measure. And first on the pro side, we'll have Casey Houlihan, a local businessman.
Thank you for having me here today. I'm here representing the more than 146,000 Oregonians who signed the petition to put this on the ballot, and the many who have endorsed Measure 91, including the Oregonian, the City Club of Portland, and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans, among others. These are groups who have never before supported a marijuana legalization measure, but they've read Measure 91 carefully, and they agree that it's the right thing to do now. Last year, over 10,500 adults in Oregon were arrested or cited for marijuana offenses. That's one every 39 minutes and two during the course of this event. These arrests occur in every county in the state. There were over 2,000 citations in Lane County last year, as well as over 100 arrests. According to Oregon State Police, there were over 99,000 arrests and citations for marijuana offenses in the last decade. Even if each one only took 10 minutes, that's two straight years of police work. The FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program shows that 55% of all drug-related citations and arrests are for marijuana, and that 7% of total arrests for all crimes in Oregon is for simple marijuana possession. Further, Oregon spent over $50 million enforcing marijuana possession laws last year. The data doesn't lie. There's no question about whether it's happening. It's about whether we believe this is a good use of our limited public safety resources. In Josephine County, budgets are so tight that there's no guarantee a 911 call will get any response. Yet last year, they arrested or cited over 400 people for marijuana offenses. In Oregon, white people made up 84% of the state's population, and African Americans made up 2%, yet blacks are more than twice as likely to be arrested or cited for marijuana offenses, despite no difference in levels of use. The disparity is the worst here in Lane County, where they're 3.5 times more likely to be charged. Is that really how we want our tax dollars being spent? Despite the claim that the system works now, drug cartels and drug dealers are thriving here in Oregon. In fact, many growers are connected to drug cartels from Mexico, so our current system is feeding that drug war in which over 25,000 people have been killed so far. If you don't think kids get marijuana now, go to a high school football game and see for yourself. And where do they get it? From a drug dealer who makes more money off the more they buy, who doesn't ask for ID, and who doesn't provide any drug education, and who wants to upsell them harder, more dangerous drugs. It's illogical to believe that this system works better than regulating it by the public. Treating marijuana use as a crime has failed, and it certainly hasn't deterred use by teens and young adults. And the resources it takes could be spent on way more important things, including violent crimes, identity theft, scams against senior citizens, tax dodgers, and more. A regulated system for adults over 21 is the only logical approach in this day and age. And it can't just be a loose system. There need to be the right regulations and restrictions in place. Measure 91 has 36 pages of very detailed regulations, restrictions, and rules, along with providing the OLCC and the state legislature the ability to continue refining and renewing these rules and guardrails to make the system safer and better moving forward. A regulated system means legal use for adults 21 and over only. It means all penalties remain in place for providing marijuana to a minor. It means selling takes place in legal, licensed, inspected stores. You can't use it in the store, you can't buy as much as you want, you can't use it in public, stores can't be located near a school. The taxes from the marijuana, which are estimated to be between $26 and $100 million a year, go into a special marijuana account where 40% goes to our schools, 35% to law enforcement, and 25% to drug treatment and prevention programs. Drug prevention programs are woefully underfunded here in Oregon. In Washington and Colorado, they now have these programs and curriculum and educational materials and an intentional, focused effort on deterring use by teens. There are risks with any change, but if you're concerned about kids, then you'd want to do a better job of deterring them from using marijuana. The current system fails at that. Drug dealers have more control than anyone. We can better protect our kids with adequately funded prevention and education programs. If you're worried about shrinking the black market, then they need competition. And unlike Washington and Colorado, the proposed tax rate in Oregon is lower, simpler, and better positioned to undermine the black market. Regarding road safety, it's currently against the law to drive under the influence of any intoxicants, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, NyQuil, or prescription drugs. Measure 91 does not change that. Field sobriety tests work, and a regulated system funds training for state and local police for recognizing impaired drivers. And the measure requires continued improvement of technology to test for impairment. Why wouldn't we want a system that pays for itself by improving our law enforcement's ability to test for impaired driving on our roads? The 99,000 arrested or cited for marijuana in Oregon over the last decade are not just numbers. They're people. They're people who will now face significant challenges securing housing, financial aid, and employment. Even a minor violation can radically change the trajectory of a person's life. The bottom line is that under our current laws, police and sheriffs, district attorneys and judges are spending thousands of hours and millions of dollars targeting small marijuana users instead of focusing on the organized crime of drug cartels and gangsters that run the illegal marketplace. A legal, regulated system with strict controls will do a better job controlling marijuana, and it will pay for its regulation. Anyone that actually sits down and reads Measure 91 will likely agree. This is a strong, well-regulated law to replace a badly broken system. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey Houlihan. And now we have Daryl Fuller, who's a spokesman for the Oregon Sheriff's Association, for the con argument on Measure 91.
Well, good afternoon, and go Ducks. I want to mention just, or sort of hitchhike on just one of the things that the proponent said. Marijuana is pretty easy for teenagers to get. I think we can all agree on that. He talked about the high school football game, and if you go to a high school football game, there are probably drug deals going on. By a show of hands, does anybody think that legalizing marijuana for people over 21, that kids are all of a sudden not going to be able to get pot at the high school football game? How many people believe it's going to stop that from happening? It's going to have no impact on the black market, but you are going to put a layer of legalized marijuana on top of the black market. And if you think that's a good idea, then you should support the measure. How many people, just out of curiosity, because it is 36 pages, have read it? Anyone? We've got one person that has read, the two people that have read the 35-page measure. I encourage you to read it before you vote, because a well-educated population is going to do a better job of making good decisions. Just out of curiosity, just so I know who I'm talking to, how many people have already made up their mind and you know how you're going to vote regardless of what you hear between now and the election? How many people absolutely are going to vote for it no matter what? All right, so you know everything there is to know and nothing's going to change your mind. How many people are absolutely opposed and you don't care what you hear, you're going to oppose measure? A couple of people. How many people here could admit that they don't know everything about both the measure and marijuana, and you're willing to learn and make a decision based on what you learn about what the measure actually says? Okay, you're my audience. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you're here today. What would you say, again, by a show of hands, if you had a measure in front of you that said that anybody that owned a weapon and had children under 12 in their house had to keep the weapon unloaded and locked? Would you support such a measure? Any of you guys support the idea of keeping guns away from kids? How many of you would support the notion of lowering the age of alcohol and cigarette consumption to 16? Anybody in favor of that? Some of you are in favor of that. Okay, not most of you, not. So here's my point. Most people generally are thinking, you know what, legalizing marijuana, maybe not that big a deal. I could probably support it. But you don't want a free and open market. You want to restrict dangerous things from kids. You don't want people that are too young to understand the implications to get a hold of this stuff. Well, if you look at what Measure 91 actually says, okay, it's going to allow people to purchase large quantities of marijuana. And by large quantities, by the way, I've got some information you're welcome to come get after we're done here that'll talk to you about. Every individual gets 4 mature plants, a half pound of dried marijuana, a pound of edible marijuana, and 72 ounces of liquid marijuana, and up to an ounce of concentrated marijuana. That's per person that each person gets. But what I think ought to concern us the most are the edibles. Have you ever heard of a cigarette brownie? Probably not. Can you go to the store and buy a alcohol-infused candy bar? Well, you can't. But you can go to legal marijuana stores in Colorado and Washington and get marijuana gummy bears and marijuana ice cream and marijuana butter and marijuana Pop-Tarts and marijuana Captain Crunch cereal. Okay. And those products are going to be in homes, and nothing in this ballot measure requires people that own these legal, edible products to keep them away from kids. Now, responsible parents will. Responsible marijuana users, they'll put the marijuana products on the top shelf away from the kids, of course. Are all parents responsible? Would you be concerned about your kids or grandkids going to somebody's house when there's a box of Pop-Tarts, not Pop-Tarts, that's the exact same size, the color of the box is exactly the same, and the picture on the box is almost exactly the same as a box of Pop-Tarts, would your kids and grandkids check the label before they grabbed one? Just yesterday, in a newspaper in Colorado, a man was arrested because his daughter got into the drawer and ate his chocolate bar. His chocolate bar, which was a third of the size of a dollar bill, so not very big, she ate the whole thing. Well, she had read the label. It was 22 servings of THC, and she almost died because she ate the whole candy bar, the whole Pop-Tart, or the whole whatever the product is. You guys are a super legislature. You get to vote yes or no on a bill. You don't get to amend it. All I encourage you to do is to read the bill, okay, and consider whether this is the right product at the right time. And if you read it, I think you'll be encouraged to vote no. I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll come up and get the information that I've brought. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl Fuller. Finally today, we have proponents of the Equal Rights Amendment, Measure 89, Aaron Gould, a local attorney. All right, she's asking, apparently their board president is on her way up the stairs right now. So in the spirit of letting her get here, I do want to provide some background because it's relevant to City Club. The Portland City Club has a panel that examines measures and makes recommendations to the club, which then votes. Sometimes the recommendations of the panel are accepted, sometimes they're rejected. I mention this on the ERA, not only because I'm trying to kill a little time, but also because the members of the City Club of Portland overturned the recommendation of the panel in that case. So one of the things we on the board have been looking at is, do we want to endorse ballot measures? That is something we've done in the past. We've done study groups and endorsements previously, but we haven't done it lately, largely from lack of volunteers. If you would be interested in having us do that again, one, I encourage you to volunteer. We operate on volunteers. But two, tell a board member or somebody, you know, have a discussion about how you'd like it to be done. Would it be a vote of the membership? Would it be a vote of the board? How would you like it presented? Would it only be a board if it was presented? Would it only be a recommendation if certain other criteria were made, like not a 50% majority, but a two-thirds majority? So please get back to us about that, because we like to think we play an important part of democracy and signaling and letting people know who don't have time to research the issues like we do. But how we do it, I think, is important, and how we decide to do it as a group is also. All right, why don't we take a break, and you know what we'll do is we will start with the ERA right before our question and answer session. And so with that, we will want to discuss at tables and come up with your own questions to ask after our ERA presentation and after our break. Thank you very much.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Okay, and I misunderstood. In fact, we have Leanna Littrell DiLorenzo, who is the founder and president of Vote ERA, here to speak. And Erin was holding her place while she fought traffic. But so now we will have Leanna Littrell DiLorenzo come and speak for the pro argument on Vote ERA. As soon as she's done, we will have the pro and con speakers come to these tables for your questions. So as soon as you see them come up, please make your way up to the chairs for questions. Thanks.
Hi, Eugene. Wow, I don't know if everybody's trying to get here early for the game. That's what Aaron told me. But I did see one guy pulled over fixing his tire. And after that, I went, of course, within the speed limit all the way here. So thank you for having us. One of the reasons why I came to Eugene is that I used to go to school here. And I'm born and raised in Coos Bay, Oregon. And so any opportunity I have, I mean, I only live in Portland, I love to come to Eugene. I think one of the first things that I should address is, why would somebody focus on the Equal Rights Amendment after all these years? And the question is, because women still are not equal in the U.S. Constitution, and because women still do not have equality in case law in Oregon or in the Oregon Constitution. So I've been working on the Equal Rights Amendment for about 10 years, and a lot of my focus has been on the federal ERA, which means that I've tracked for about 4 years in a graduate program all federal legislation relating to any women's rights since 1984. And so one of the things that I see is women's rights rolling backward. And so with respect to the Measure 89, the Equal Rights Amendment that will be before you to vote on about, you know, 3 weeks prior to actually November 4th, this is really important. This is not symbolic. It isn't just a fun project. It's not something that just will help federal momentum with a federal ERA. And I should state that a lot of people ask me to explain this because there is some confusion. Yes, the Equal Rights Amendment passed one time in 1972. That was the federal ERA. When you amend the U.S. Constitution, you have to have 3/4 of the states ratify that in their state legislatures. So the ERA is also one of only 2 constitutional amendments that ever had a deadline. The other one was prohibition, and that passed in 18 months. The second one is the Equal Rights Amendment. And so it expired in 1979. They extended it, meaning they, Congress, by 3 years. And then the final deadline was June 30, 1982, and it fell 3 states short of ratification. So as we stand today, the federal ERA has been introduced in Congress every session since 1923, since when it was first drafted. And so today what we have is we've got 2 strategies. We've got something called a 3-state strategy, something called a sort of start over, if you will. Senator Benjamin Cardin is running the 3-state strategy. The goal is to remove the deadline, which is something Congress would have to do, so then 3 more states could ratify. The other one is to start all over. So what I believe, and I'm really not alone, is that we need this in every state constitution. And sure enough, during the 70s, 22 other states put the ERA in their state constitution. And what's interesting is there are even some in the lower Bible Belt, if you will, that didn't ratify the federal ERA, but they still placed it in their state constitution. So where are we today? The United States of America polling on the Equal Rights Amendment has always been in the 80s. It has not changed. When you look at the state of Oregon, whether it's gender, race, political party, any geographical corner of Oregon, it's above 80%. What we did was we had a little fun and we even tested the language. Would you vote yes or no on something that says equality of rights shall not be denied or abridged on account of sex? It was almost 80%. We then went one step further. We said, if you were told that women had equality in case law, do you still think it's important to place the Equal Rights Amendment in the Oregon Constitution? It was almost 80%. So let's spend maybe 30 seconds on case law. Here's the deal. If Article 1, Section 20 provided equality for women, they would, under that same language drafted in 1857, been able to vote, serve on juries, go to law school, work the same hours as men, etc. They couldn't. And if Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution provided equality, why then would it have been necessary to even have a 1983 case, Hewitt versus Safe, where Justice Betty Roberts said, men and women are equal? Now, the last part of that is very important. There's an exception in the case law, and it says, except for biological differences. And I'm here to tell you, because I'm in Eugene, Oregon, and you're all highly sophisticated politically and intellectually, that this is the problem. This has always been the problem for a century because it's called governmental interest. And that means if the government finds a reason that they think you should not have equality, whether it be your medical procedures or equal pay or what have you, that is the avenue. So please work with us, Measure 89, vote yes, we need this, thank you.
And with that, I'll ask the proponents to come up here to the near table and the opponents to the far table, and that'll be easy for you all to ask your questions. And if you do have a question, please come up now. Now, we do have a rather limited period of time, so I'm going to ask our speakers to be as brief as possible on time. I'll give you a minute, and if you can make it less than that in your response, please do.
Don't fall.
Don't fall off the edge. And for the questioners, please make sure you address at least which topic you're bringing in. I don't care if you remember which number you have, just the who you're asking the question of. And with that, to your questions.
Yeah, well, it is Mark Baker.
Greetings. Thank you for coming and educating us here today. My name's Paul Thompson. I'm a City Club member. My question has to do with the marijuana proposition. I'd like to hear something from both the pro and the con people, and that is, 2 years ago, we had a proposition relative to legalizing marijuana. It was rejected by the voters at that particular point in time. What is different about this proposition as compared to the one 2 years ago?
Well, I'd like to start off by saying that this is an entirely different measure than the one that we were running 2 years ago. That wasn't us, in fact. But this measure obviously has a lot more regulations and restrictions in place about who would be able to obtain it. It actually uses the existing infrastructure that we have in state government to regulate marijuana sale and production and distribution and processing. This has strict limits on how much individuals are able to produce. It has a clear path for how people can obtain licensure to become licensed, legal, regulated producers. The bill 2 years ago did not have any of these restrictions or measures in place. This is a bill that could really work with what we have now in Oregon and what we'd like to see in terms of reducing teen use and making sure that kids don't have the same level of access that they do under the current failed system.
Thank you for the question, and I'll mimic some of what my opponent says. This is apples and oranges comparing the two. The previous ballot measure was written by a layman. This one was written by a downtown Portland law firm, so it is a much better written proposal. We certainly would agree with that. One of the differences is this gives the regulatory responsibility to the OLCC. So just think in your mind how well OLCC does with keeping alcohol away from kids. They're going to do about the same job keeping alcohol and marijuana away from kids.
Thank you, everybody. My name is James Baldock. I've been a member since 2012. My question is to the driver's license ballot measure people. My table was skeptical that illegal immigrants would voluntarily pay for a driver's card, pay for insurance, give up their address to a government agency. I'm curious, like, what benefit are the illegal immigrants getting that's incentivizing them to sign up for this card? And is there any evidence that they would?
Thank you for the question. We asked this question when we were developing the legislation about why would folks who are undocumented declare this and try to get a driver's card. Remember, it's not a license, it's a limited driver's card. And it came down to folks do not want to be afraid to drive to the store, to church, to work, and to shepherd their kids around. So there's a year residency requirement. So they're already here. There is also, does it require insurance? No more than it does for us. I can get my license, get my car. The car is the one that gets insured. But we have found in other states, as well when we did research on this, that having unlicensed, uninsured drivers is worse for all of us. So it's better to have people who know the rules of the road and be able to get on the road. And I got the stop sign, so I'll be quiet. But happy to talk about this further offline.
Well, my response to that is yeah, it's good to have people that know the rules of the road, but it's also good to have people that follow the laws of our country, the laws of our state. As I said, we're a country based on laws. We have our sovereignty. I'm a U.S. citizen myself. If they can't follow the laws of our country and the laws of our state, what makes you think that they're actually going to be motivated to follow the laws of the rules of the road? As stated earlier, illegal is illegal is illegal, period. They're here illegally. They're breaking the law. They've already broke the law once to be here illegally. So there's no motivation at all whatsoever for them to buy insurance. There's no motivation for our roads to even be safer. As I stated earlier in my speech, New Mexico's rejecting it. Tennessee has rejected it. There is no guarantee that our roads will be safer. Thank you.
My name is Joel Korn. I have a question for the lady who opposed the GMO labeling. Part of your argument was that there's a discrepancy, that the pizza that's delivered to your door doesn't have to be labeled, but the pizza that you buy in the store must be. Would your group support the bill requiring labeling without exemptions?
Thank you, Joel. That's a good question. You know, our coalition is a broad coalition of farmers and food producers and businesses and taxpayers and consumers. We've all come together really for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to defeat this flawed labeling requirement that doesn't provide accurate information. So within that coalition, there's going to be a broad range of opinions of what kind of labeling should be there. But I think one thing that everyone can agree with in our coalition, I probably think everybody, labels have to be accurate and reliable in order to be useful. If there's all these exemptions and these loopholes and the mislabeling of products saying there's GMOs and then when they're not, then it fails consumers. It gives them bad information, and that's where this measure fails. It's on the bad information that it provides. Instead, we should look towards our national labeling systems. There's two of them that provide accurate and reliable information, and they don't have the loopholes and special exemptions that are contained in Measure 92. Consumers who prefer foods without GMO can look for organic or non-GMO labeled food.
I'm Jane Smith, and this question is almost identical to the former one, but I'll ask it anyway on behalf of one of our guests. You pointed out that there were exemptions, and if, in fact, 92 passed, would you then urge food producers to voluntarily provide labeling information for these exempted products?
Thank you, Jane. I'd be happy to answer that question. You know, voluntary is where it's already working, and we see the marketplace working the system already. You know, Chipotle restaurants, as I mentioned, Ben and Jerry's, both have voluntarily decided to label their products or to change their ingredients in those restaurants. And there are tens of thousands of food products and actually entire grocery stores dedicated to foods that are non-GMO free. That system is working. It's reliable and it's accurate and it's providing consumers what they want. I think what we're looking at here for Oregon food producers is that many food producers in the state would be required to put an inaccurate label on their product. That is not something that is beneficial certainly to them, and most importantly, it is not beneficial to consumers. It misleads them and gives them bad information. You know, under the way this is written, it won't tell consumers which ingredient is GE and by how much. They won't know if there's an exemption. They won't know if there's actually GE in it. That's bad information to consumers.
John DeLow, City Club member, and let's beat on this subject a little longer. If the Measure 92 passes, what will companies who label their food products as GMOs free have to do to demonstrate their products are GMO free?
Sorry, this is Skyer. I'll take a shot at answering that. The Measure 92 dictates that you have to state if you have it in it. It does not state that you have to say you're free as a result of that. So you don't have to label, you have to say you're free on there, but you are free, and that's based on an affidavit system. So farmers, as they farm, you know, an affidavit system would go up the supply chain. So, you know, saying, hey, I produce this product, and that would move along to the, you know, manufacturers and producers.
I would agree with that in that the food companies that currently enjoy the and have certified for the non-GMO label or the organic label, it wouldn't change what they're doing. It would change what every other food company that sells a product here in the state of Oregon, how they would have to change what they're doing. You know, I recognize that there's a lot to this issue, and when you start looking at it and thinking about it more, you realize there's a little bit more complexities to it. And last month there was a panel of Oregon voters. They were representative of 20 voters representing the entire state, and they spent 4 days in Salem looking at this issue and another one actually and analyzing it thoroughly. That Citizens Initiative Review Panel, it made a recommendation for a no vote on Measure 92, partly because it increases the costs and it provides bad information to consumers.
I'm Kari Johnson, a City Club member since this summer. Our table heard that the ACLU is against the ERA, and we wonder why. And also, we want to know what laws would specifically change if this was passed, and what the specific benefits would be.
I am so glad you asked that question. It's strange, right? An organization that's been around almost as long as the ERA has been running, why they would have a problem. So what we have is this. We have the ACLU actually said they didn't have a problem with it about 2 or 3 months ago, and that's an Oregonian article. Yuxing Chang wrote that for any of you out there with notepads like yourself, maybe wanting a resource. I don't know. It's odd, bizarre. I'm not going to bash the ACLU. They're wrong on this. We have 4 Oregon former Supreme Court judges who, and I have a copy of the letter with me, and it's actually online, which is www.voteera.org. And they wrote an open letter to the public saying that the ACLU is wrong. That's stated in the letter, and they go through it. And basically what they say is due to the biological differences exception in Hewitt versus Safe, the 1983 case law, women aren't equal, and you should put that explicitly in the Oregon Constitution. Not only that, but the state of Oregon has 2 legal opinions on it, and the language is in our initiative that says this provision is not in the Constitution. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Flynn, and I'm a member of City Club through the sponsorship of the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. And I do want to thank you for moving Measure 89 forward. When I first heard about it, it felt like a blast from the past, and I thought, wow, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? So I would just love to hear more from you on what the 3-state strategy is and help all of us understand if it does pass here in Oregon, what happens nationally. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Great question. The other thing that I should add, first and foremost, is we have the endorsement of the governor. Both U.S. Senators Rod Wyden and Merkley, our whole Democrat congressional delegation, and NAACP, Boys and Girls Club, YWCA, Urban League, AFSCME, ACLIU, and so on. And those are also on our website as well. So to backtrack under the timeline, how does this provide something specific? I find it absolutely amazing, like I told OPB in my house 2 nights ago. Isn't it interesting that women for a century are on the defense to prove why they should be equal? Like, that's not enough. But I love that. So what it does is it provides state policy. So you know this whole equal pay thing that we've been hearing about? The governor, as we know, has provided his stats. They're all paid very well and equally. That would be one thing. It absolutely establishes state policy. What else does it do? It protects women so they can make their own choices within medical procedures. It does a whole lot. And it prevents rights from rolling backward. 3-state strategy. The ERA hasn't passed in 91 years federally. It's a really great strategy. I support it. If we pass this in Oregon, it'll be the first of 20 years. We will make a huge national statement. It will help it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all of you, for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program, Ballot Measure Speed Dating. And thanks again to our sponsors, Evans Elder & Brown, Capella Market, and KLCC. We meet again next Friday, September 19th, at the Downtown Athletic Club for What Will Move Oregon Education Forward, with guest speaker, Superintendent Sheldon Berman. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you all so much for being with us.